This is continuing live courtroom coverage of the Take Care of Maya trial from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Please be seated, everybody. This is case number 2018 CA5321, Jack Kowalski, etc. et al. Versus Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital. Starting with the plaintiffs, let's take appearances. Ms. Lawrence.
Samantha Lawrence, Greg Anderson, and Nick Whitney for the plaintiffs.
Howard Hunter, Your Honor, with Ethan Shapiro, Pat Crowell, and David Hughes for the defense.
My understanding is it's bumper cars again out on the roads, and there's several accidents, so a couple of our jurors are caught up in it. I'm still hopeful that they'll be here by 9, but it's possible that we might have to wait for them a little bit.
I guess for all the exhibits.
Let's go for it.
Yes, before we do exhibits, the defense team, we met last night. The defense, and I'm sure the rest of the trial, does not want to not be able to do closings next Monday, given everything. So we have trimmed our sails, so to speak. We anticipate, barring unusual circumstances that might occur today, that we will only have 2 live witnesses tomorrow, 2 nurses. They should be done. Seriously, they should be done by mid-morning, but given how things roll here, maybe by lunch. So we anticipate the plaintiff could do the rebuttal tomorrow afternoon, and we can proceed with closings on Monday.
You know, that works for me.
Well, I don't know why it wouldn't work for the plaintiff as well, Judge. I mean, we seriously have real concerns, given the schedule that's available next week, that if we don't do closings on Monday, that we're going to be looking into another week, and we think everybody wants to have closure for this case, and we think that that's doable.
I mean, I certainly don't want the defense to feel like they can't present their case if they feel like they have a witness they want and or need.
No, Judge, we appreciate that. We understand the court will allow us to put on whatever testimony we think we need to put on, but we have...
Cost benefit. Cost benefit.
You know. Yeah, we did the analysis, and we believe it's we think it's almost essential that we the closings get done on Monday.
So we basically need to get in all exhibits in.
We're down to our last list, Judge.
Plaintiffs, you're going to be in a position to do your rebuttal starting mid-morning to early afternoon.
We're doing depots this by video this afternoon, am I understanding a number of them?
As long as we need a couple responses back. We have 2 live witnesses today, Judge. I'm sorry.
Dr. Alexander
this morning. Dr. Dolan is after lunch. We don't anticipate either of them being extremely lengthy.
Again, we should have published depths.
We should be able to publish depths this morning, and then the rest of the afternoon would be depths. We don't have that many depositions left. We have 2.
I just ruled on Padrone this morning.
Which is very short, you could tell. I mean, that's probably 10 minutes, maybe. And then we have O'Leary Johnson, which is 30-some minutes.
Yeah, 33 minutes.
And we have Dr. Wyndham.
Wyndham.
So my assistant will be circulating the Padrone rulings. Are there any other deposition designations I'm going to have to rule on?
Well, we have designated last night some deposition designations from the plaintiff's staff. I can't imagine that there's going to be any objections to those. We're waiting for their response on that. And if they can get back to us at lunch, and we can have those clips ready as well for this afternoon. Again, 15 minutes most for those. So I think we're in good shape, Judge. The 2 witnesses tomorrow, again, will be here first thing.
So, plaintiffs, you need to be ready to go with your rebuttal case tomorrow.
You won't see much of me this afternoon, Judge, but yeah, I'll get it together.
And we need to know who the rebuttal is going to be, Judge, as soon as possible.
Well, I can tell you that Maya Kowalski will testify, probably Jack Kowalski, Dr. Richards, Dr. Corcoran, And we may have a brief excerpt from the deposition of Kathy Beatty. And I think that's about it. Anybody else?
Dr. Neuberger.
Oh, if we can get him, Dr. Neuberger.
And we're going to have to just keep calling and find out. We have not been able to get his status in the past 48 hours, but we'll keep trying. And if he can appear by Zoom, we'd like to bring him in too.
Well, I just want to make sure we are not trying the Chapter 39 case, right?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Judge, we have concerns given the list they've given that is going to be true rebuttal and not a retry of their case.
I hear you. I agree. And they're also, that 2.5 hour limit is a hard and fast.
Oh, yeah.
And we're not just calling people to call them to say the same thing over and over again.
No.
Well, Judge, you're hearing the defense's concern that they just want to have the last word and therefore going to call it rebuttal when it's just to come up and say things they already testified to.
I hear you. I've said what I can say now. I can't make a ruling until I actually have a... Now, as far as directed verdict motions, let's time shift those.
Okay.
So when the defense finishes its case, I want to immediately go into the rebuttal, and we will shift any sort of plaintiff's directed verdict motions to later. And then when we complete the plaintiff's, you know, my goal is, let's say we finish on Wednesday afternoon, we will then time shift until after we send the jury home and then do any DV motions, and then we'll get back into jury instructions Wednesday afternoon.
Understood.
Mr. Hunter?
I just wondered, Cole, do I have any proceedings on Thursday morning?
We're going to do jury instructions Thursday morning. And, you know, we're going to start at 8:15 on jury instructions. I would absolutely love to be out of here by 10:30 on, because I really need to be someplace else, but this will take priority, and I'll stay until we finish what we need to finish. But hopefully we can finish jury instructions by mid-morning on Thursday, which will give everybody 3.5 days for closing arguments. Let's not leave today without talking about rules for closing arguments.
Yes, it's almost like I want to write it out and submit it to the court to get a pre-ruling. It's going to be tough, Judge, but we'll do our best.
We're going to talk about the ground rules, because I know you're going to have this weekend to work on them.
Because it's punitive damages, too, so...
We're going to talk about it before we leave today.
I have a motion related to our rebuttal. I'd like the court to reconsider the Williams ruling for Elena Kushner in light of Sally Smith's testimony that she never wears a lab coat. Elena Kushner and her husband are in a NECA action, and there is a companion state court action in which the defense is actually defending it. Right now it's up on appeal to the First District Court of Appeals. But the point is, they know the Kushners. And Elena Kushner, her testimony would simply be, I came in, and it will be very, very similar to, if not identical to, the situation with the Kowalskis. And Kathy Beatty came in a white lab coat and asked a number of questions before anybody identified her. Nobody came in from the hospital to identify her. Nobody told them anything about it, and Sally Smith didn't tell anything about it, which corroborates our evidence and refutes Sally Smith's testimony. I don't think it could have come in until Sally Smith said, I never wear a lab coat in these circumstances. But because she did say that, then it becomes relevant and material to rebut that statement. And between the issue between who remembers what, it would be probative. So obviously she's only a 5 to 10 minute witness, but we would like the court to consider that.
Judge, I don't think there's anything that happened here in court that would cause the court to revisit his ruling.
Let me think about that a little bit more. What's next?
Our concern, Judge, with the next witness is that, again, I know the court doesn't like these things brought up at the last minute, but neither do I know what they're going to have Dr. Alexander testify to, and the basis for this is his report is pretty specific about Chapter 39 things. His affidavit is very specific about Chapter 39 things. And in his deposition, after we ask that many questions, I mean, the question was, and Doctor, in the discussion we have had about your anticipated testimony and what you will be asked to testify about in front of a jury, you have no issues of what we talked about and what's been disclosed, right? And he went on. Now, that is a summation of about 4 pages of me asking, are there any other opinions beyond those expressed within your report?
I don't understand what you're asking me. Is he making, is he opining that Beata had Munchausen by proxy?
Well, yeah, in this part he does. In the report, he concurs with that, and I don't think that's...
I think from the discussion yesterday, the defense wasn't going there.
Well, may we inquire of the defense as to exactly what issues Dr. Randall's going to talk about? Alexander, excuse me.
Mr. Anderson, didn't we have this discussion yesterday?
Yes.
I don't recall it, Judge, if we did. The specifics of the issues?
Well, maybe you had left and it was Mr. Whitney was flying the plane for the plaintiffs.
Could be. I mean, I just need some confirmation then. If you want me to ask Nick, I will, but if they can tell me, it'd be even faster.
I do have a sense of deja vu. The testimony is going to center on Sally Smith's conduct and the propriety of that conduct and then the parameters of her medical directorate of the CPT. We're not going in. I may make a proffer regarding Munchausen's. He was recruited as a Munchausen's expert way back when. And that was indeed the focus of the testimony that he was expected to give when he was initially recruited. I'm not going there. I'm strictly going to talk about the propriety of Sally Smith's conduct. That's it.
There we go.
Yeah, and my concern, and I wish I had been here, I apologize for not being there. I was preparing for this eventuality. But nothing in his...
All the jurors are here now, so just to let you know. All the jurors are now here. So.
We need to get to exhibit.
I know. So here's my... We had a discussion about this yesterday. I was satisfied with the discussion. I trust in your ability to stand up and not object or ask to approach the bench. And I think at that point, you know, we are where we're at. Let's deal with exhibit. Is there anything else before we go to exhibit?
No, I was just going to observe that there's a couple of typo points that may have me coming forward.
That's fine.
Yeah, I would appreciate that, counsel, before asking.
Let's go to exhibits, please.
Ms. Crowe. You should have a current list. I believe this
is only 2 pages.
And I believe it concludes our exhibits, Judge. The first one is for proffer only. We understand the court has ruled that that's not admissible. It's the policy that we wanted to get in. The court denied us being able to admit
that. What number are we talking about?
I'm sorry, 3019, 1-14. It should be the first one on your list.
3019, pages 1-14.
Yes, we want that marked and proper
so
it.
The court will mark, but without, but will not admit 3019-1-14.
3023-1-56 is the Arnold Palmer Hospital that need to be redacted. I'm going to hand to Mr. Whitney. What I've done is tab and highlight what we would redact, and then if he could. If you could just let us know by lunch if they're satisfied with those redactions, then we will seek to admit that after lunch.
What's next?
3035-1-26. It's Nemours Children's Hospital records regarding the transfer.
This was 2016, or was this? What was
2016, it? Sorry. It's
when in 2016?
October, and I think it also includes in November. Attempts to transfer to
Morse. And this is the transfer that never happened?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And are there documents or statements in there that we previously addressed to which we've had some lengthy hearings on?
I don't think so, Judge. If you like, we'll take a closer look at those, but I don't believe there's anything in there. I don't know if the plaintiff has reviewed it.
Is that something that you need this morning, or can
we'll
they look
at it? We'll get that.
Yeah.
Okay. 3054 Venice High School records, we redacted page 11, which was the page that had all of the...
The RN comment?
Yeah. Let's Clay, can you bring up 3054 page 11 specifically? There it is.
And we've removed any sort of social security or telephone number?
I think we had already done that, Judge.
Last time we discussed this, we just weren't certain whether or not the rest of the pages, the remaining 15 pages.
No, the rest of the pages are grades, but okay. Feel free to review.
Well, if that's the case, no objection.
And we have looked to make sure there's no social security number. We
will double check, but I'm pretty confident.
Okay,
we'll
so ultimately that's going to come in, but let's just wait for the confirmation.
So 3085 is the entire EEG video, so we're not going to play it, but it is all of the EEG clips from when she was in the room.
So it's a two-day?
It's on a, what do you call them? I call them pen drives, but whatever.
Probably a real thick one. Is there two?
Yeah, that's four, Your Honor. They were previously admitted.
No, we previously admitted little clips, but
right,
she's talking about 48 hours.
Oh, okay.
This is the 48 hours.
Any objection to 3085?
No.
And so the court will receive 3085. Does the clerk have that external drive, or is that something that's coming?
It was the original one that was provided to the clerks.
Okay, so the clerk already has 3085. Okay. The court receives 3085.
3101, the video of Maya ice skating in January of 2019. It's about 20 seconds long.
Let's roll tape.
We didn't slow-mo it, just how it was produced to us by the plaintiffs.
No objection.
Court receives 3101 into evidence.
3192. It's an email from Beata Kowalski to Dr. Kilpatrick on November 6, 2016.
Can I see it, please?
The importance of this, Judge, is that she is advising Dr. Kilpatrick that Maya's relapse started in September, with it progressively increasing and declining slowly over the next 30 days, which is right before the admission to All Children's Hospital.
And I see we've got Deborah Salisbury's name on.
Oh, I thought we deleted that. We'll remove Deborah Salisbury.
Plaintiffs, what say you?
There's an attachment that's missing.
We just want the...
Well, can we pull it back up?
I don't know what that, forwarded in a letter, Dr. Hannon. That was the subject matter, Judge. If they want to put it in the letter, we just simply want the admission that's contained in this email regarding Maya's condition before she entered the hospital.
We'd like to see the letter to sign on completeness. And then as far as this email, if it's
completed with the attachment. You have no objection to this email?
Judge, I don't think we're required to put in the attachment.
Well, can we see the attachment, please?
I don't know that I even have the attachment, Judge.
Should be the next number.
I don't think it is. Well, look, 3192-0002, but I don't believe we have the attachment. Maybe we do.
Maybe we just have what they produced to us.
Yeah, this was produced to us by the plaintiff, so if they have it.
And we have a completeness objection.
Judge, it's just for the statement contained regarding the plaintiff's, Mrs. Kowalski's statement regarding Maya's condition. There's no reference to the attachment in the substance of the statement.
I'm going to go ahead and admit 3192 if the plaintiffs, because I agree with Ms. Croyles, this is a document that originated from the plaintiffs. If you have the letter and you want to put it in, then I'm certainly probably going to do it as part of a, you know, this is the complete.
I understand.
For now, I'll let in 3192, page 1.
3200123. We have the original, and then we have a redacted version. We want to put in the redacted. So this is the redacted. It's an email from Beata Kowalski to Dr. Kirkpatrick, and his response. So her email continues on the second page. And then Dr. Kirkpatrick's response regarding Dr. Chopra. And if the court wants to see the original, we can put that up.
Yes.
This Dr. Chopra evaluation was done in the context of Chapter 39. So this is getting into the family's motion to the court to have Maya Kowalski evaluated by Dr. Chopra. We'd also like to see the unredacted version.
Sure. Be happy to show you the unredacted version.
But we think as it is, it's a Chapter 39 issue.
But except Dr. Chopra testified here.
As a retained expert, not in his role in Chapter 39.
He only examined her once. So it's referring to that examination.
Well, let me see page 3, and then we'll see the unredacted version.
Well, you know, we also have a hearsay objection for Dr. Kirkpatrick.
Okay. So I've now seen the redacted. Can I see the unredacted version, please?
And
I'm
redacted next
to
each other, Judge? No, that's okay. And next page. So we redacted all the things that we thought were referencing the Chapter 39 issues.
Next page, please.
And the GoFundMe stuff. That's what that is. Oh, no, it's not GoFundMe.
I agree with the plaintiffs that the context in which these statements were made has to do with a defense of the dependency court action. I'm going to exclude the redacted version of 3200, pages 1 through 3. What's next?
Let's skip to 3239.80. This is for proffer only, Judge. It's a page in Beata Kowalski's journal where she comments on giving ketamine intravenously.
Okay, the court will mark for identification purposes only 3239-80. Not being admitted at this time.
Yep. Mr. Shapiro wanted to address that proffer briefly.
Very briefly, Your Honor. On direct examination of Maya Kowalski before this court on October 9th.
Well, then let's put it up, because if it's something more than a proffer, then... Okay, so Mr. Mr. Shapiro?
Yeah, I know that courts already ruled that the references to IV ketamine being given through the port won't come in, but I wanted to make sure for the appellate record I could perfect this proffer that on direct examination of Maya Kowalski on October 9th, 2023, in front of this court, Mr. Anderson directly elicited this testimony at page 85 of the transcript. He said, before we go on, by this point, did you know what having ketamine infusion was, the feeling of ketamine inside you? Answer, yes. Were you able to tell throughout this period after you had started having them with Dr. Kirkpatrick, Dr. Cantu, and Dr. Hanna, were you able to tell when your body was receiving ketamine? Answer, yes. Okay, then tell the jury whether, to the best of your knowledge, and for everything you saw, heard, felt, your mom ever gave you IV ketamine at home? Answer, never. Through the IV, no. And then the question was asked again. Okay, so it was never intravenous, only for oral purposes. Right, right, never through the IV. Question, you never had IV ketamine at home? No, at home, no. So again, that would be an additional basis since the plaintiff opened the door to this in their direct examination. The jury's been left with the direct impression that this never happened, and I don't want to go through all of this again, but we believe that it's prejudicial to the defense that they were allowed to elicit this testimony in direct examination and put in front of the jury that this never happened when we have what we believe is rock-solid evidence that it did, especially as they wave around their IV ketamine charts. So that's our proffer on this exhibit in addition.
The Dr. Sally Smith chart?
No, the one that they showed yesterday to Dr. Levy saying, here's all the IV ketamine she ever got during this period of time when we have evidence as seen on the screen that, you know, quote, ketamine IV given out of desperation, pain was unbearable. The plaintiff opened the door to this on the direct exam, and we believe the defense is
No, my understanding is the chart that they showed yesterday, actually, its genesis was Dr. Sally Smith.
No,
she didn't create that?
No, that was created by the plaintiff as a demonstrative.
there is an underlying chart of Dr. Sally Smith that correlates directly to that.
In one of her reports. And that's where we traditionally, defense and plaintiff, have been using that determination rather than going back through in depositions on multiple occasions. The defense and the plaintiffs have used that chart.
Well, going back to the IV ketamine, I again will say, since the moment I stepped into this case, and I think the summer of 2021, this IV ketamine issue has existed. I continue to have substantial concerns about the unfair use of this concept, and it's, you know, the unfair nature of it vastly outweighs any sort of probative value. So I will continue to exclude, and so I will not permit into evidence 3239-80. Did I get those numbers correct?
You did.
Okay. But,
Your Honor.
But that page will be marked for ID.
Yeah, okay.
I understand it's excluded, it's like a proffer, but for the clerk that may eventually read this in this context, ketamine IV, again, through the prescriptions, it's been confirmed by the pharmacist that the oral ketamine was prescribed in ketamine IV form, so this note does nothing to prove up that it was administered through the port at home. It simply does not say that.
And say that when you said the clerk, you meant the law clerk slash staff attorney?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah.
3310-1-30 is Dr. Cantu's billing records.
Let's see them.
It's Dr. Cantu and the hospital that billed her for the next
job.
The first ones I think are the booster. And then later on in the package is the ones for the initial.
Is it all in English or is there Spanish?
I think there might be some. I think it's in English. And Spanish. It's a mix.
Spanglish.
The numbers are in English.
Yeah, we object. So the court will recall that previously
we had raised the issue of the Kowalski family having to sell their rental home in order to finance the treatments of Kirkpatrick and Cantu. And the defense objected to us introducing that. So now to put in billing records from a time, we're not claiming damages for Dr. Cantu's treatment. I'm not sure what the relevance is.
Be happy to explain.
If it is relevant, then we're going to come back in rebuttal and talk about all the sacrifices the family had to make in order to fund this treatment.
Judge, they already put in evidence their request that the church do fundraisers for them. But beyond that, that's not the purpose. The purpose here is to show that Dr. Cantu makes a lot of money doing these comas, and it goes towards the jury's consideration of his bias with respect to the procedures that he performs.
Well, what are his bills versus what are the facilities bills? And I don't speak Spanish, so I'm unfortunately not going to be able to translate these documents.
Mr.
Your Honor, he testified that these bills were for everything.
Well, but if the point is to somehow impeach or contend that Dr. Cantu is biased, what do the facilities charges have any relevance at all? Wouldn't it just be Dr. Cantu's professional services?
Yeah. Clay, can I ask Clay to scroll through, please? Can you keep going? This would be the hospital bill. So we can remove the hospital bill if that's the court's concern.
In my mind, if the purpose of this is to say that Dr. Cantu is receiving a lot of money, then it would seem anything besides his own personal bill is out.
All right.
Now, I still have to address Mr. Whitney's concerns. So is 9 through the balance, is that not Cantu's?
No, it's not that organized because I think it's by two trips. We'll have to reorganize the pages, Judge, and we'll give it a new exhibit number and deal with that tomorrow then.
What's next?
33151.
All documents produced in response to a request.
No, it should have been changed. That's how we got it. But it's via Mrs. Kowalski's email. We'll change that description, Judge, for the exhibit list. It's Mrs. Kowalski's email to Dr. Cantu. Note that it's October 3rd, 2016 that she sends the email. And then his response on October 4th, 2016. Objections
are hearsay as to Dr. Cantu's statements, relevance as to this would again be some sort of backdoor effort to establish that Beata Kowalski was, infusing these drugs or obtaining a pump without a prescription from a physician. There's no evidence in the record that any of these drugs that Dr. Cantu identifies here, morphine, clonidine, ropipcaine, wherever administered through a pump as of March 10th, 2016.
This is October 3rd, 2016.
Okay. Same idea. There's no evidence on October 3rd, 2016 that there was ever a pump, a prescription written for a pump. They want to use this to, again, establish Munchausen by proxy, that Beata Kowalski was abusing her daughter with all of these drugs simply by asking a question of Dr. Cantu.
Judge, do I need to respond?
Yes, because I'm about ready to exclude it, so I'll give you another chance.
Yes, because this is talking about an internal pump. The jury's heard all about, it says, could you please send me the info for the combo drug for internal pump? We'll take out Dr. Cantu's response if that's concerning the court, but this goes to, the court may recall, there was all this conversation when Beata Kowalski was in the hospital about wanting an intrathecal pump. That would be an internal pump. This is goes to support the fact that that was her inquiry, that was her concern, that's why she didn't want the transfer to Nemours in October. And it goes to the concern that she had for her daughter and her condition as of October 3rd, 2016, when they are testifying that she was doing great, and was the expert did, and that we're the ones that caused her to decline.
The court has already told the jury a couple times, and I'm going to tell them again, that the hospital had reasonable cause to make the call to the abuse hotline. I see this as nothing more than a piling on of saying Beata Kowalski is a bad person. That's how I'm reading it. 403, it's out.
Okay, Judge, but just for the record, the plaintiff's interpretation of what they think we're doing is not accurate, and this goes to the condition of Maya Kowalski before she goes to the hospital, but I understand the question.
There's a lot of evidence of what Maya Kowalski's condition was, and so there's also a cumulative nature here.
I'm
now,
sure.
We're past 9 o'clock.
Oh,
so
is the jury here, Judge?
The jury is here.
Okay.
So can we put a pause and...
We can.
Okay. Anything before we bring in the jury?
What is the order of witnesses? I'm sorry if I missed that. I know Dr. Major's after lunch.
Dr. Dolan.
I'm sorry, Dr. Dolan's after lunch. The witnesses this morning?
Doing Dr. Alexander first, and then there'll be, I believe, a deposition or two. And then
The nurse cook is not testifying?
Tomorrow. So
tomorrow now? Okay, thank you.
Let's bring in the jury. Please be seated, everyone. Now, with all that orange and black, I know that we are honoring Sarasota High School. I want to confirm while you're away, you did not discuss this case amongst yourselves. You did no investigation and received no information. Is that all correct? And no one approached you about this case. Is that correct? And you saw no media. Is that correct? So in addition to all the orange and blue that I know that you are loving, the orange and black from Sarasota Hive, I feel like you just know that I went to high school there and are honoring Sarasota Hive, as well as the University of Florida. Okay. Let's go ahead and shift. I know today's Halloween. But let's go ahead and shift to the business of why we are here. The defense, can you please call your next witness?
Yes, sir, Your Honor, speaking of the University of Florida, we call Dr. Randall Alexander.
Thank you. stand here, face the clerk, and raise your right hand.
Do you solemnly swear or affirm the testimony you're about to give will be the truth, the truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
All right, come around this way.
Police Gordon. Can you tell us your name, please?
It's Randall Alexander, and Randall is R-A-N-D-E-L-L.
And what is your occupation?
I'm professor and chief of Division of Child Protection and Forensic Pediatrics at the University of Florida in Jacksonville. All right. I'm a child abuse pediatrician.
Very good. Could you tell the jury where you obtained your training to be a pediatrician, first of all?
Well, I got a bachelor's degree at Michigan State University in 1972, and then went to the University of Michigan, got a master's degree in 1974 in psychology, worked on a PhD, but I went to medical school at Wayne State University in Detroit, got my MD degree in 1980. I did a standard 3-year pediatrics residency in Grand Rapids, Michigan, which is Michigan State's largest clinical campus. And then I did an additional year working on community pediatrics fellowship, more informal at that time, where I was working on child abuse issues, and also being a chief resident. And then I got my first job at the University of Iowa.
All right, sure. And at the University of Iowa, what was your appointment?
Oh, I started out as an assistant professor and eventually became an associate professor.
All right, and in what field?
It was in pediatrics. I was working in Division of Developmental Disabilities and doing some work with that, with children with a wide range of physical disabilities. We were kind of the state resource for school issues, learning problems and things. And also I was doing a lot of child abuse work at the university, state and national.
All right, sure. And where did you go from Iowa?
I went to Morehouse School of Medicine. In Atlanta for 6 years.
All right, sir. And were you involved with child abuse pediatrics at that point?
Oh, yes.
All right. Could you describe for the jury how you became involved in child abuse pediatrics?
I think in medical school, there were some interesting cases when I was on the pediatrics rotation. It's not your standard look in somebody's ears and see an infection. Which is satisfying, but there's more complication with child abuse. I worked with, I did a pediatric radiology rotation with four of some of the top radiologists in the country working on child abuse issues. And so I think that sparked some of my interest there. And then my residency, there was more of that. And ultimately, my third year residency, I did a month working with a guy at Michigan State, Ray Helfer, who was probably the premier child abuse pediatrician in the world at that time. And then I took off from there.
All right. So what did you do at Morehouse State? What was your teaching interest?
It was Morehouse School of Medicine, sorry.
I'm sorry.
I did about a day a week of general pediatrics, but most of the time I was working in child abuse issues. I worked statewide, got some money from the legislature, trying to put together a bit of a network with the various cities in it, Georgia. Got some money for some equipment, for instance, was seeing cases.
Did there come a point at which your career path led you to Florida?
Well, I was being recruited over several years to come down there, and I showed up there in 2004, and I was the statewide medical director where I oversaw all the child protection teams, which is currently 22 teams. And so I was the boss of the medical directors in each of their different locales.
Okay. And how long did you hold that position?
10.5 years.
All right, sir. Did there come a point at which you became board certified in child abuse pediatrics?
Yes. Child abuse pediatrics has especially came about, and the first wave of people that were child abuse pediatricians formally as a formal subspecialty was in 2009. At that time, you had to have worked over half-time at least for 5 years in child abuse, and then you had to pass a national exam. And I did.
And then you continued to work as the statewide medical director for the Child Protection Team program?
I did for 10 and a half years. Now I'm the I'm in Jacksonville, but I'm in charge of the Tallahassee and its 8 counties Child Protection Team, and Jacksonville and its 8 counties Child Protection Team. So 16 counties.
All right, sir. And in that connection, you're still working as a member of both these Child Protection Teams?
Well, I am. I was on call this weekend, and I'm on call tonight. So I, when I get back to Jacksonville, I may have to see patients in the middle of the night, although I hope not.
Okay. Let me backtrack a little bit into your credentials here. What is the American Professional Society on the Abuse of Children?
What we call APSAC. It is the largest, somewhat the only, multidisciplinary professional organization in child abuse. And so it spans not just medicine, but psychology and social work and police and a whole variety of people that deal with child abuse in one form or another.
And have you been a member of that organization?
I'm a member. I'm on the board. Have been in Florida. I was on the board and at one point was the president in Georgia. And I've been on the board twice nationally.
All right. Have you had occasion to contribute to the literature of your profession regarding the subject of child abuse?
Yes.
And do you have any estimate of how many papers you've published?
Oh, gosh. Well, it's over 50 in terms of paper publications. Books and chapters, 70, 80. I'd have to look at my CV on that. I'm sorry.
Okay. And have you had occasion to lecture on the subject of child abuse?
Around the world, yes.
Yes, sir. Do you have any estimate of how many times you've been asked to lecture on that subject?
I'm sure it's at least 300. Might be a fair bit more than that.
Okay. And at the University of Florida today, what is your role in teaching child abuse?
Okay, so I'm the division chief. I have about 50 or some people that work for me in my several locations. I see kids. I'm on the call schedule. I also have administrative duties supervising people. We have the only child abuse fellowship in Florida, and I'm the program director for that. So I teach and help with any of our fellows, people who are pediatricians but are trying to spend 3 years to be a child abuse pediatrician. And then I work on some prevention issues and try to sneak in some occasional complications.
All right, sir. Now, do you know Dr. Sally Smith?
I do. I was her boss for quite a long time.
Okay. During your tenure as statewide head of the Child Protection Program, you were her boss?
I was. That would be 2004 to, I think, probably early 2015.
Okay. And during 2016, you did not hold that role?
That's right.
Okay. During 2016, were you in your present position?
Yes.
All right. Have you and I had occasion to meet and discuss this case?
Yes.
Okay. Did we meet for the first time last night?
In person? I think that could be, yeah. Okay. I think we may have done Zoom or telephone or something before that.
All right. And have you been paid, or have we agreed to pay you a fee for your consultative and testimonial services?
Not me, the University of Florida. It's not any money I get, but the University of Florida will be billing you, yes.
All right, very good. Now, let me turn your attention, if I can, to the subject of the child protection teams in general. Your background suggests that you have had occasion to become familiar with how the Florida Child Protection Team program works. Is that true?
Well, sure. I mean, I was leading it for a considerable time, and I still have to teach it to all my trainees and new staff and everything. Yes.
Is the Child Protection Team program something that is created by Florida statute?
It is. It's had several revisions, but since it first started in 1978.
Right. Could you describe for the jury what the Child Protection Team program consists of and what its function is?
Sure.
Objection, relevance, and 39.
He can answer that soon we're going to.
Yes, sir.
Florida, uniquely in the world, is divided into 22 zones. And in these zones, if you will, we have a child protection team. So we don't work just out of a hospital. So, for instance, in Jacksonville, we have several hospitals we work for. Under Florida law, first of all, we're paid through the Department of Health, and we have to conform to a whole bunch of rules. It's somewhat of a public-private partnership. So in our particular case, the University of Florida holds the contract, our Jacksonville College of Medicine. In, say, Pinellas, it would be a nonprofit. And most of the places in the state, it's some sort of a social services nonprofit. But there's, I think, five of the 22 teams are University of South Florida, Miami, and a couple of the UF ones. By law, we are there to assist the Department of Children and Families in their investigations. We're medically led with a medical director, but we have other medical people, all told probably over 100, and a couple hundred what we call case coordinators or social workers, if you will, psychologists, team attorney. And we see under law, they specify, here's the kids you're supposed to see. They're called mandatory. So we see these kids by statute, but we also see other children because there's some that need to be seen that the law can't think of everything. And we write reports, and we help to decide, is there even child abuse in the first place? And if it is, what is it, and what our recommendations would be? And we have a number of quirky things that you only find here in Florida and not any place else in the world.
Let me try to reframe another question if I could. Doctor, can you tell the jury whether the function of a child protection team includes the education and outreach to the community and professionals regarding the subject of child abuse, its awareness and prevention? I'd like to approach on this, Judge.
Sure. Mr. Hunter's going to rephrase the question.
Doctor, in your experience, is outreach to the community and the professional community to provide education and awareness regarding child abuse prevention and recognition part of the function of a child protection team?
It's a contract standard. We actually have to provide a certain number of hours. The teams do, according to the Department of Health contract standards. So the answer is not just yes, but it's required.
Now, at our request, or I guess I should say at the request of counsel, can we approach on that just a minute? I'm sorry.
More live courtroom coverage of the Take Care of Maya trial from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today is coming up. Press subscribe now.